So I've got a question for all the video game lovers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware, with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These really are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance, so I'd visit alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark.
Retronauts is part of the HyperX Podcast Network. Find us and more great shows at podcast.hyperx.com.
This week on Retronauts, we reveal the secret of the ooze. Everybody, welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey. Today, we're talking about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the Cowabunga Collection, out now for all major platforms, along with some minor ones. And by the way, this episode is sponsored by Konami, who provided us with copies of the game before release. Hashtag ad, hashtag sponsor, just in case you're wondering. Before I go any further, who is here with me today? Who is here across the table from me as normal?
It's appreciator of pizza power, Henry Gilbert.
And who do we have on the line? Our special celebrity guest who has something to do with this compilation.
Hello, it's me, Chris Kohler. I'm editorial director at Digital Eclipse. And this is exciting for me because, you know, of course, I've been on Retronauts on and off since 2006, since the very beginning. But this is the first Retronauts I'm doing as the guest developer of the game we're talking about, which is pretty cool, if you ask me.
Now we can criticize you, Chris.
That's right.
No,
oh,
that's not going to happen.
There was that Penny Arcade, right, where like they put out a game and they, you know, they had the journalist saying like, you know, what's a score lower than zero or something like that. That's what this is now.
Turnabout is fair play. But yes, Chris, you're now with Digital Eclipse. You've been with them for a few years now. I think you worked on the Blizzard collection of games,
I think. Yeah. I'll run through it. Sure. Yeah. So I joined just over 2 years ago in July of 2020. We put out the Blizzard Arcade Collection, which was the Lost Vikings and Rock and Roll Racing and Blackthorn. And then we did actually worked on the Space Jam game a little bit, writing a lot of the script for the Space Jam, A New Legacy, the game. Then we did the update to Disney Arcade. The update to the Disney Classic Games Collection, which is the one with Aladdin and Lion King. We added in SNES version of Aladdin. We added in the Jungle Book, and then a whole museum section dedicated to the Jungle Book, and then Cowabunga Collection, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Cowabunga Collection, August 30th, and then Atari 50, the anniversary celebration, which is coming out in November, and then more stuff too.
Wow, a lot has happened in 2 years.
Yeah. It really has, a lot.
And Chris, you were not with the company at this time, but it's because of Digital Eclipse's Disney Afternoon Collection that I am together with my wife.
Oh my gosh!
By happenstance, her work on the cover of that compilation brought us together.
Oh my gosh,
I don't think
of course.
Without that it would have happened.
That's so funny.
Digital Eclipse, thank you so much. But before I go on, so Chris up front is going to answer all of our burning questions about the compilation, his work on it, and then we're going to touch upon all, I believe, 13 games very briefly, and maybe Chris's insights on what he learned about those specific games in the process of making this compilation. Before I start, though, I do want to learn about all of our history with the Ninja Turtles. Now, we did a Ninja Turtles episode earlier, I believe in summer of 2019. We did episode 230. That was just called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in 1989, because it was 30 years later. 89 was the biggest year for the Turtles, for the most part. And we discussed every turtle-related thing that came out that year. And I'm sure we told our stories on that one, Henry and I. But we can just briefly recap that. Henry, you and Turtles, where do you start? Where did you end?
Oh, yeah.
How many action figures did you have?
Two. You know, in my memory, I didn't have that many. But then when I see characters on screen in these games, I'm like, why that guy? I'm doing that. I would say I would say I probably had a good four dozen turtle figures bought over, and I had the blimp, and I had the van, and the thing that shot pizzas that were manhole covers. And the skateboard that Michelangelo had. Now, when I list all these toys, though, know that these were shared between my brother and I, who also loved Ninja Turtles. So
they were communal toys.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I love Ninja Turtles. It came at the exact time I wanted to see Ninja Turtles. I played all the games. I watched the show for the first 4 years. The first two live action movies were events for me in my life. I walked around wearing multiple Ninja Turtle shirts, including one with my favorite turtle, who is Leonardo.
Okay.
I'm the boring guy who likes Leonardo, but his swords are cool. And then I played many of these games, though. Also, now that I've had some time to mess around with the collection, I'm also like, man, I was dumb. In 1994, I think I started thinking, I'm too good for new Ninja Turtles games. And when I see them in this, I'm like, oh my God, me and my brother played the NES ones together all the time. And then we missed out on a few that I know we would have loved. I would have made so many more happy memories with it. But my brother and I played a whole lot of the first arcade game, Turtles in Time, and the first two NES games, and I also played the Game Boy game a ton, and then a little bit of all the rest of the stuff in here. Yeah,
I guess we should also name our favorite turtle when we talk about the turtles. For me, it's Raphael, you know, because I am the cool but rude guy on Retronauts. And also for me, I mean, I told my story on that episode, but for me, I don't really have nostalgia for the cartoon or the movie. I only had a few of the action figures. My nostalgia for turtles goes back to these games, because this is the way I interface with that IP the most. Like, I played everything in this collection except for a few of the Game Boy games. I was there for every one of these games. And in the 4 year span that this compilation covers, I was playing everything, and I enjoyed all these games so much. And I guess I kind of outgrew Turtles as Turtles was winding down in like 93-94. Like, I dabble with Tournament Fighters, but after that I was on to different things, like more adult shows like Beavis and Butthead and The Simpsons. But I do have a soft spot for the Turtles, but it really just is about the video games. Like, I think I can just go the rest of my life without ever seeing the cartoon again. Maybe the first five episodes I'll go back and revisit one day, but my nostalgia is on these Konami releases. And Chris, what's your history with the Turtles? I think we were all appropriately marketed to when it comes to this gang of four.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, so I think I'm a little bit older than you guys. So I mean, my whole thing was when I was that age was He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. Like, those were the toys that I bought, because I was born in 1980. And so by the end of that, I was kind of like, I was not going to like move on to another action figure, you know, collecting phase. So I didn't actually, when the Turtles kind of hit in like 87, 88, like, I was actually good on action figures. And in fact, that was when we had got an NES. So really, my desires to like own toys but had kind of shifted into my desires to own NES games. And so my fandom for the Turtles was 100% kind of like localized in the games themselves. Like, we saw that arcade, that four player original arcade game, you know, fell in love with it because, oh my God, here is this thing. And I think we talked about this when we discussed the Simpsons arcade game on a different podcast, all of us, but like, just the fact that Konami was able to essentially create something that just like looked like a cartoon, sounded like a cartoon. You know, you're in the bowling alley of the arcade, you hear the Ninja Turtles music playing, and you look over at the TV that's embedded, the monitor in this arcade game, and you see like the Ninja Turtles, you know, cartoon, essentially. Like, it looks like it's playing on this monitor because the graphics are so great. And I mean, it's this massive machine and the four joysticks, and I mean, how could you not be attracted to that and go over to it and start looking at it? This incredible. We played that, you know, we played the original Turtles game for the NES, and then of course we really wanted, you know, them to put the arcade version on the NES, which they then did. And I just really, like, I knew that a new Turtles game, if a new Turtles game came out, that, like, that was something really special and that deserved to be looked at. And so, you know, from Turtles in Time, even Tournament Fighters, you know, so that was really like, I saw the movie, you couldn't escape it. It was inescapable in those days. It was so culturally powerful. It was like the best-selling toys, the most popular games and TV shows and the movies. It was like the biggest indie movie ever, you know? So even if you, like, I wasn't like a huge Turtles guy, but like, it was just everywhere. Like, the show was always on TV, so I watched the show and I saw the movies, and but really the games were the thing that I was super passionate about.
Yeah, I mean, I think I know, Henry, you were into He-Man, right?
Yeah, a little, I came at the tail end of He-Man and Transformers as a kid. And yeah, I was born in 82, so that was winding down, and that's why I think we were ready to be like, oh, TMNT is our thing. Like,
right.
That is, we're 2 years younger than than Chris's generation, who had the Transformers and G.I. Joe. Like, those are the three biggies: He-Man, then Transformers and G.I. Joe. A couple years after that,
yeah.
And of course, one of those things, the difference between being a kid and being an adult is like those 2 years from like 87, 89, that was so big and so many things happened in it. And now 2 years of video games is nothing to me. I'm like, oh, it took 4 years between these video games and its sequel. Who cares? Like, I'm the same person.
That's like the time between a Dragon Quest release in Japan and America. Just like the localization.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, not to go on too long about the source material, but for me, I think it was particularly successful because I was not into any other action show except for this. And I think why it really worked on kids, a lot of like fun monsters, a lot of fun designs, but also humor was a big part of it, mm-hmm. too. And I think I don't know how much the creators were drawing from other media, but I feel like it has a lot in common with anime and manga, and where there's like so much theming going on that's why Power Rangers was the next big thing, because the theming was so intense. Just like there's colors, there's weapons, like everybody has their own different theme they're working with, and I think they really drew upon that idea for future big IP for kids.
I will say the thing that pulled me away in my personal preferences, now that I think back on it as you list the timeline, you know, Turtles comes out into the 80s. By 92, you got Batman and X-Men, and then Spider-Man a little after that. I think that's when my love affair with the older guard of comic book heroes pulled me away from the colorful Turtles, and I didn't look back. Once I fell in love with Spider-Man, I was like, I'm sorry, Leo, you're second tier to me now. I'm
poor
sorry.
Leo. But yeah, that's basically our history with the Turtles. And if you want to learn more about the Turtles, go to Wikipedia, or I don't know, are Turtles streaming anywhere? Can you watch those classic episodes?
Oh, the classics?
Yeah,
I think,
because
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure where, but I mean, there's a lot of them. There was like 10 seasons or something like that of what these games are based on, that
yeah.
series.
Which that shows you how popular that series was. Not to get into animation history, me and Bob's other thing, but, you know, if you got your 65 episodes, you were a strip show, meaning you could be 5 days a week for 13 weeks with new episodes. That means you could air it 4 times in a year, and boom, you've covered your syndication package. But if you made more than 65, then you had to be the biggest thing that was on, like, because most companies just go like, well, yeah, we have our 65 episodes of Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers. We don't need more. But Turtles went on for like more than double that length, I believe.
Yeah, I think wherever you look in all of the, in whatever media you look at during that time, Turtles is essentially either leading or is up there, if it's not like far ahead of the pack. I mean, you know, as I started looking into this, so to jump ahead a little bit for Cowabunga Collection, you know, we didn't just get behind the scenes materials from Konami. I actually flew for a week out to the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, where they have, you know, this huge archive of stuff related to just anything related to play, but like toy industry stuff as well, and went through issues of a magazine called Playthings, which is the magazine of the toy industry, and was finding, you know, everybody was just talking about Turtles during that time period. And if you look at the like the top 10 list of toys and things like that, Turtles figures were like, you know, either it, not only were like Turtles figures always sort of leading, you know, as far as like the top selling toys, but there were months where Turtles, the original Turtles for the NES, was the number one selling game, like, in America. But not only that, it was the only individual video game that was even on the top 10 list. Like, you'd see, like, like the NES action set, that would count as, like, a toy, right? Or, like, you know, the NES power set was one toy on the top 10 toys. But then Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, NES, would appear on that list to be the only single video game. And, I mean, apparently it sold worldwide 4 million copies, making it like the biggest selling third party game on the NES, period. Like, big.
Wow.
We've now mentioned Dragon Quest twice, like bigger than Dragon Quest. It's crazy when you look at like how Turtles just dominated every medium that it went into.
Yeah, that game launched at a really opportune time for the Turtles franchise, because I think 89 fall, that was the year that they had daily episodes. They were able to make enough. And if you look at the back of the original NES box, it says like, oh, the four Turtles from the comics are here in NES form or whatever. It's not even mentioning a cartoon, mm-hmm. because I think it's like, well, we're basing this on the entire idea of Turtles right now.
Yeah. Well, and them on the cover of the game, it's the red mask and tail version of them, too.
Which is taken straight off of a variant comic book cover, which you can find in the comic book covers section of the Cowabunga collection, so you can actually compare the two.
So let's talk about the Cowabunga collection, Chris.
Let's do it.
How did this come in depth?
Yes,
How did it come together at Digital Eclipse? And it should be noted that in the last 30 plus years, only a scant few of these games have been re-released. I can think of two offhand. I can think of the original Konami NES game that was on Virtual Console for about 6 years or so. And then the arcade game was on Xbox Live for a bit. And I want to say Turtles in Time was on some
disc. It got
disc.
A remake, didn't it?
There was a remake, but I think it was also on some disc Turtles game, like a GameCube game. Or like a PS2 game or something like that. I could just be misremembering, but
I believe
only
right.
two.
Yeah, essentially. Okay. Yeah. So essentially, like bits and pieces here and there. Yeah, never any kind of cross-platform big initiative. So, I mean, kind of what happened was, and I'm speaking a little bit, my knowledge of what was sort of happening behind the scenes at Konami is that, so Konami had put together the Contra and Castlevania and the arcade, the anniversary collections that they did, and there was a very noticeable groundswell of people on the internet saying, we want Turtles, where's Turtles? Turtles was not as big in Japan as it was in the US and in Europe. And so, you know, for Konami in Japan, maybe it wasn't on their radar as strongly as, Contra, Castlevania, things like that. So now, they can see there's a very clear groundswell of support for Turtles. Okay, let's look at Turtles. Well, it was kind of like, what seven games should we put in this collection? So the Contra or the Castlevania collections. And the response from the US side, Charles Murakami, our producer at Konami in America, you know, was no, we've got to do all of it. And really the feeling was like, this is potentially the one shot to do it. If we're going to do it, it should be every game, because every game is somebody's favorite. Let's do this definitive collection, because ultimately, you know, the stars kind of have to align to make something like this possible. So if we're going to do it once, let's do it the right way. What ends up happening is, Konami Japan is like, wow, Charles, you seem very passionate about this. Okay, you get to be the producer on it. So now it's handled through the America side with the American team, you know, producing it at Konami. And so they're like, great, we want to go with Digital Eclipse. We had worked with Konami on Yu-Gi-Oh! Games and stuff like that, so we were not unknown to each other. We really like working with Konami USA. They like working with us. So we put together, you know, kind of working in tandem, this pitch for all 13 games, and this is how we're going to make this essentially a more premium product, quite frankly. It's going to have, you know, a retail version or physical version, rather. It was very, very shortly after I joined the company that Turtles, which had been, they had been talking about it for a long time, you know, and finally got greenlit, you know, all the negotiations, you know, Nickelodeon and everything, it all kind of come together. It got greenlit. We did not start working on it right away. But then once that started to ramp up, I found myself not for the first time at Digital Eclipse with essentially like this, you know, blank slate of starting from zero, like, what are we gonna put in this? That is how it all got started.
What's that? Majestically cresting the horizon as it makes its way into port. Why, it's the brand new HyperX Armada monitors, mounts, and arms. Both the HyperX Armada 25 and 27 gaming monitors come bundled with a sturdy HyperX Armada mount and arm. If you need every split second of advantage when gaming, the full HD Armada 25 and its 240Hz refresh rate are for you. If you like to soak in the graphical majesty of your gaming, you'll be eyeing the Quad HD Armada 27 with an 165Hz refresh rate. Set sail for HyperX.com or Amazon.com to start making your display Armada.
Yeah, you were mentioning Turtles not being popular in Japan, despite that's where all of these games come from. I don't think it's apocryphal, Henry. You might know this. Didn't Turtles take Evangelion's time slot after that show ended?
The opposite way.
Oh,
the Turtles
okay.
aired. There's people, some hardcore anime fans have shared online the commercial of this was the last episode of Turtles aired, and then there's kind of a television promo from Japanese TV from the network saying that's the end of Turtles, everybody. Great time. See you later. And then what's coming next week in the time slot? And it is a trailer for the first episode of Evangelion,
wow.
which is, yeah, mm-hmm. People said, like, I'm stealing it from the people who tweeted me, said, like, this is how they grew up. Like, this is how they became teens in Japan, that whole generation.
No wonder that baton passed shock people. I mean, yeah. Unrelated anecdote, but it must be told on the air somewhere. But, Chris, like, from the beginning, what did you want to include? What were you hoping to include in this collection as far as... games, extras, anything along those lines?
Well, I mean, at first it was like, you know, my feelings were, let's make sure that, you know, starting from the basics, you know, I want to make sure that we have really nice scans of all the boxes and the game's manuals. And actually, Charles at Konami was a huge help, because even before this project even got greenlit, he was like, well, I feel like we're going to be doing this, so I'm going to go out and I'm going to build a collection of all the games, all the US and Japanese versions of the game, so that we're ready to go. And so once it got greenlit, he was like, okay, I already have all the boxes and I already have all the manuals for both US and Japanese versions. I'm like, well, that makes my job a whole heck of a lot easier. And then, you know, again, it was more like, well, let me do this. Let me take this mission to the Strong Museum. Let me see what I can find there. And then let's ask Konami, you know, what they have. And we were kind of the vibe from Konami was that they figured they did have some stuff, but that they weren't sure what it was or how much there was or if they were going to be able to get to it. Because essentially there is this, as I came to find out, there is a building that is like in an undisclosed location. It's not in the Konami headquarters. It is a several hours train ride away from Konami headquarters, located somewhere in Japan. And that is where the Konami archive is of all of this development materials, because it does seem like Konami actually did at some point decide, like, we need to make a concerted effort to preserve this stuff and have this at a centralized location, which is great because, as you know, I mean, not every game publisher decides that. And so it took a while for somebody to get in there. Only few people have access to it. And that, like, our producer at Konami was not one of those people. And so basically he was like on. Also, it was like the height of COVID. So he ended up like on FaceTime with somebody who was in the archive, you know, months and months later, after we'd already kind of like gone to the Strong and scanned stuff and found whatever else we were going to be able to put in. They start pulling out like binders, and they're just like, okay. And like opening up this binder, and it's all this absolute treasure trove of like pencil sketches and design documents for these games. And they're going through with a phone. And they're like, would any of this stuff be of interest to you? And he's like, all of it, get it all. And then they're like, okay. And they pull down binder number two. And they're like, okay, this is for tournament fighters. And they show a binder that's like inches thick. And so even in tournament fighters for the SNES, we have all of these original sketches of every frame of animation for all of the fighting, for all of the competitors. All their special moves and everything that were originally just sort of drawn in pencil on like animation paper. And like, and we were able to scan all of that. It was just shy of 1,000 pages of design documents were in the Konami archive, and it's all in the, every single page is in the game. And so when we got that, we had already executed on the plan for what if we get nothing. So the Turtles' lair in the game is, there's the soundtracks, there's screenshots of the TV show, there's the covers of the comic books, including many, many variant covers, things like that. Then there's the design documents and the boxes and the manuals and the advertisements. I mean, the Strong had the first press release for the first Turtles game, and they had stuff that was that magazine, Playthings magazine. They had like trade ads that were never seen by the public. So all these ads, all these graphics, all this sort of behind the scenes stuff, it's all in the Turtles lair. And then there's actually to round it all out, there's a search functionality where you can go and click on radio buttons in the museum, and you can actually do a search and say, I want to see every advertisement for a 16-bit game that features Raphael. And you can just sort of click those buttons, and then the game will sort of build you a little custom gallery of every magazine ad for a game in the 16-bit generation in which Raphael's face shows up at some point. And you can do that for major characters. You can do that for minor enemies. You can do that for vehicles and things like that. Anything that had a proper noun, essentially. Like, if you like Krang, but you literally just want to see images of Krang's two-leg battle walker, not the full android body, but the two-leg battle walker, like, you can do that, and you will be able to see everything, whether it's a page in a manual, a design document, a reference to it somewhere, an ad, whatever, it'll just that. And that was the laborious task that Charles and I took on, of just going through a total of almost 2,000 individual images and stuff like that, and just tagging all of them, which everything that appeared in there. But you do that work and you do that labor, and then it just sort of becomes this, it sort of becomes magic, because when the player is interacting with it, they don't see all that sort of meticulous work that went into it. It's just a thing that just magically works, which is super cool.
Yeah, when tinkering around with all the bonus materials, I assumed going into it, well, yeah, you know, box art and ads. I wasn't sure how deep it would go until I started looking into all the development material. And to me, that's the most interesting stuff, especially I loved looking at the design docs for the NES game, because you can see just the concept on the page, but also the people drawing the turtles and the enemies are drawing them in a very, very cute style. So you have these yes. nice little manga style illustrations of little turtles doing things. I found very, very adorable. But yeah, I was shocked to see these items were preserved, and I'm happy Konami did preserve them. And I also think there was a weird urban legend that, like, that Ninja Turtles game was just some reskinned other game. This definitively proves, like, no, it wasn't. Here is a design doc from the beginning that shows the creation of this game from the very beginning.
Yeah, and clearly, they had thought about, that Turtles 1 on the NES, they really thought about, okay, well, what do? They live in the sewers. Okay, well, let's craft this game where the sewers connect places in New York City, so you have to travel through the sewers in order to get to this. It was definitely not something that they sort of like, hacked into something pre-existing, for sure.
Yeah, and just looking through it and seeing, like, here's how for the first NES game Bob was mentioning, like, to see just the original drawing of, like, here's Donatello's reach versus Raphael's, just seeing it drawn on the page by the designer, 36 years ago or whatever, over 30 years ago, is amazing to look at. Like, these are the kind of documents you don't often see, and even if they exist, aren't always shared. So to see it there, it's amazing.
And then importantly, again, even just looking at some of these documents by themselves, even if you can't read what's on the page, because it's all some designer's, handwriting in very tiny Japanese sometimes, as you say, like, some of these illustrations, they really went above and beyond drawing these adorable, like, turtle illustrations for the storyboards or the design parts of the documents. But then we actually went ahead and, for most of the documents, the ones that really needed it, we translated them. And so you can turn on a layer that brings up little floaty boxes around the document that show you actually what it says, not only in English, French, German, Italian, Spanish, but then also we have boxes in Japanese, because if you sometimes it can be very difficult to stare at somebody's handwriting, but we can actually bring up the Japanese transcription as well, which hopefully for our fans in Japan, they will appreciate that. Or if you want to use it for language learning, if you're looking at that, well, what does that say? Oh, I see.
What I also personally like seeing was you could also see the basis of all of the art from Turtles in Time, all of the sprite art. And I love that game because just like the Simpsons arcade game, everything's a little off model in a fun way. And the very iconic sprite of a squished turtle is you can see the pencil drawing where that began. So I love seeing the roots of all of these things that are now etched into my mind.
Yeah, we said it on the Simpsons arcade podcast we all did together. But yeah, this the kind of gag manga aesthetic that came into those things to come into both of those types of games from the great developers and artists back then. To see on the original page how the actual like drawing for the gag was made and then brought to life in pixel form is just it's magical really to look at it.
It's I will always remember that day when I opened up that zip file when it was like, okay, here's what we got, and I opened the zip file and it's folders of stuff and just like randomly clicking on a folder and starting to look at stuff and just being like, oh, this is just the first thing you open up. It's like, oh my God, this is brilliant. Look at that. It's hilarious. And then to realize that there's so many more folders in this zip file and there's so much more stuff. it was quite a task just to like get it all organized. Mostly it was organized because the binders had been organized, but like all of the Turtles 2, the arcade game stuff was like in a folder marked Manhattan Project. And so then once you start looking at every one, it's like, oh, this is, oh, okay, well, this is actually Turtles 2, the arcade game, or the NES Turtles 2, the arcade game, and Manhattan Project kind of lumped together, and kind of like reorganizing stuff. And, you know, that was a fun project for my brain to get to, like, you know, organize everything where it correctly went, and then kind of like categorize it, like, well, what do I call this stuff? How do I differentiate this from that, you know, so that the user could kind of like know what folder they're about to jump into and stuff like that. That stuff is just so cool. And I mean, for me, it was just like, we were Konami and Digital Eclipse. I mean, everybody was totally on board with the, with this, we must publish all of this, you know, it was not about picking and choosing in any way. It was like, this is our, again, like this is the opportunity. Like this is the opportunity to take this all and make it all public and let people access it and to hold stuff back. Hold back for what? You know, why not just leave it all out there at this moment?
So we mentioned Turtles in Time, and one thing I was surprised and delighted by, when I started up the arcade version, the attract mode still has the Pizza Power excerpt from the Coming Out of Our Shells tour CD.
Yes.
They play a little bit of that song, and I was curious, I don't know if you have the answers for this, but were there any rights issues when it came to the many things involved with the Turtles? Was that just all Nickelodeon's deal? Did they just have everything?
No, so basically, yes. So Pizza Power, yes, we did have to go back and re-secure the rights to have that in there because it was, as you say, from the Coming Out of Our Shells tour, right? So, you know, to make sure we had that in there. The only thing is the original arcade game used a recording of the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know, cartoon theme song, for which it was not available for us to license. So there's a sound alike in there.
Okay, sure. I wasn't sure. I had an inkling. I was like, oh, it's so close. I don't know if it's just a higher sound quality or what, but I know that when Digital Eclipse re-released the X-Men game over a decade ago, they did have to re-record the voice clips, but nobody really noticed. And then if you compare them, they did such a good job that they're just almost, they're so indistinct from each other.
Yeah, we tried. We tried. We tried hard.
What I appreciate the Turtles in Time also still tells me to not do drugs.
Like, yes.
That's very important to me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That Sessions is still letting us know. I wanted to also compliment, you know, you mentioned the comic scans, the comic covers. I did really like that too because I'm a comic nerd, and though I never read the Eastman and Laird original run because that was too grown up for me as a kid, but the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Adventures was made for me as a kid then, and I love those. And just paging through it, I was like, I got to like the 40 through 50 section was where I read them over and over and over again. Just like looking at the covers, like just number it flooding back to me, like somewhere in my mom's garage is the signed copy I have of a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Adventures 45 signed by the artist. And just, just seeing the scans there, I was like, oh, that's so great. Like,
Yeah. And it's really helpful because, I mean, obviously it's like it would be impossible to include the entirety of scanned comics, but what we can do is, again, because that search feature is in there, it allows you to compare and contrast, you know, what did this character look like in the comics, what did they look like in the screenshots of the show, what do they look like in the game. It kind of like gives you all of the information you might need to answer questions like that.
And this collection contains 13 games, and there are several different platforms these games were originally intended for. And I'm just curious, were there any particular challenges into presenting these games in a way that is accurate to the way people remember how they look and sound and play? It's not just, 8-bit and 16-bit, but you have arcade in there as well, and you have Game Boy. There's just so many things happening on this compilation.
Everything presents its own challenges. I think the thing that people don't necessarily think about with the arcade game is that each player only can select from one turtle, because it what turtle you play on the arcade is based on where you're standing at the machine and what player you are. So there does have to be like an additional layer where each player gets to select their own turtle. So that has to be a change that you have to make, unless you just want everybody in a single player game to have to play Leonardo. So that's like it's not like a challenge, but it is an extra layer of stuff that has to be done for the arcade games. The arcade games as well, also, they punish you for standing around, or they punish you for, actually, they even punish you for doing too good. If you play the arcade game, you don't lose energy because you're playing so well, it will like just drop a bomb on you for doing too well if you play without losing a life for long enough, basically, because it just needs to keep those quarters coming in. And so we leave that in there. We leave that stuff in there for historical accuracy. But then each game has the enhancements menu before you start it up. And for the arcade games, some of the enhancements that you can do are turning those things off, so the game no longer punishes you for either A, standing around doing nothing, or B, being too good at it. Another interesting thing that we found was we wanted to make sure that we had the US and the Japanese versions for every game. This is because we know the collection is going to be released in Japan. I definitely, it would feel weird to me to put something out in Japan and be like, oh, it's just the US versions of these games that were made in Japan. So it's like, we've got to make sure the Japanese versions are in there. You notice when you're in the menu screen and you press the change region button, if you've tried this, you notice that it's not simply just giving you the Japanese versions. It actually changes in the UI in the menu screen, changes the art to the Japanese art. It changes the titles of the games to translations of what the titles were in Japan. So, for example, like TMNT 3 Radical Rescue on the Game Boy was called, Turtles Kiki Ipatsu, which is like a close call. So like we kind of translated it that way. The original game was Geki Kame Ninja Den, which translates to like Legend of the Extreme Ninja Turtles. So, we just wanted to make sure that was in there so people understood these games came out with different titles and different sort of like marketing around them. And then for the NES versions of the games, for Turtles 2 and 3 on NES, the US versions use the standard MMC3 mapper chip. But the Japanese versions actually use chips called the VRC4. This was actually developed by and manufactured by Konami, because in Japan, you could manufacture your own games. So Konami manufactured their own games, their own chips. And so we get stuff running and oops, like our internal engine doesn't support Konami's obscure Japan only mapper chips. because why would it? We've never released anything that would use them. And so this is where I am always the bearer of bad news, and I have to go to like our engineers and say things like, so, you know, for historical accuracy, like, we've actually got to support these chips so we can run the Japanese version. And so we were able to integrate, you know, support for those chips. And so it's stuff like that. It's never like, it's never a, oh my God, how are we going to do this? It's always like, huh, didn't think that was going to be an issue. We'll have to do a workaround. You know, so fortunately, I work with this incredible group of people at Digital Eclipse that have been making video games since the days of the Game Boy Color. And so they have a lot of experience working with these, you know, vintage hardware and things like that. And somebody's always got a solution. Somebody's always figured it out. And I think that's a, you know, not to make this sound like an ad for my company, but I mean, I think that's a good reason to work with us, because we have these experts who, the problems will always come up, but they are always surmountable because we have the people to do it.
I'm actually not familiar with that chip, just the name of it offhand. Is that for the sake of better music or graphics?
No, it's a mapper chip, essentially. So it's basically like all the mapper chips that are on the NES boards are essentially, they let the NES do, because the NES, like, by itself, you have the PRG and the CHR, right? Like, that's the NROM games. Like, that's what it can do. It's got the program on this chip and character on this chip. And those are a certain size, and you can't get any bigger than that. But if you want to make them any bigger, if you want to make an NES game that's any bigger than Super Mario Brothers, you have to start adding hardware, because that has to start giving you more space for more graphics, more characters, and then more space on the program for a more elaborate computer program. And essentially, you have to have a mapper chip to kind of route all of that stuff, essentially, because the NES can't handle it internally. And so in Japan, companies started coming up with their own hardware designs. In the US, Nintendo was much more locked down on that. And they're like, no, we make the hardware. You guys don't make your own hardware. We're going to make all of that internally. So when those games came to the US, they had to be reconfigured to use Nintendo's MMC3 mapper, which is similar. It's actually very similar in terms of what it does, in terms of like the extra capabilities that it adds. But because it's simply a different chip, it just gets handled differently when you're talking about an emulator.
Okay. Now, yeah. I was actually thinking of the MMC5 chip, which was the Castlevania 3 chip, which was a contemporary game with Ninja Turtles, the arcade game.
Right, and I believe that if you look in the Japanese version of Castlevania 3, it uses custom Konami hardware, which is why those two games are actually different.
Right.
Wow.
Right. Man. Yep. Yeah.
No, it's. I mean, that kind of care in there. It also is just amazing to flip between the two box arts when hitting the region selector, because yes, you get to see that in a lot of cases the Japanese covers are cuter than the know the angry turtles with their wide eyes. Sometimes it's wide eyes, sometimes it's not. But also then sometimes you get to see that especially in the Japanese covers, occasionally the turtles look more like their live action Jim Henson company forms, even like on Tournament Fighters. But yeah, just seeing, well, because for me growing up, my favorite turtle cover was the arcade game on the NES. Like,
oh, that's a great cover.
My big smiling colorful turtle friends right there with me. I didn't realize it was also because it was Japanese. It was the Japanese aesthetic meeting of anime back then, meeting the designs from the then animated series for kids in America.
And I think you were tweeting about this, Chris. I believe there's like a hidden Watchmen reference in that cover art.
Yeah, I couldn't say for sure, obviously, there is a, like, yeah, Michelangelo has a skateboard in that cover art, and there's a smiley face in the skateboard, okay, but then there's, like, some spray paint splatter on that smiley face that just so happens to be in the exact position that it would be if that was the Watchmen, the Watchmen logo. Now, of course, this information would be totally lost to time, but maybe whoever drew that may have been inspired, I don't know.
I feel, looking at it now, I can't believe I'm Watchmen fan, super fan, and I've never noticed that before until at it right now. Yeah.
I noticed it only because I have just been staring at all of these boxes for like a year and a half.
Hey, guys. Brandon, Vin.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, Joe.
You see this thing here? Could you tell me if it's good or good or not?
Well...
I'm gonna need an hour.
Yeah, at least.
Should I just wait over there, or you want me to come?
No.
Talk it out with you guys?
Yeah.
Cool. Come on, let's go. Podrid Review. We review things so you can do things. Every week on the HyperX Podcast Network.
I'm Colette.
And I'm Matt.
It's time to talk about the most important topic facing humanity.
Climate change. Oh, okay, video games.
Every week on Colette and Matt Have Entered the Chat, we have in-depth conversations about the games we're currently playing.
We also talk to people who make video games, as well as YouTubers, writers, and podcasters that you already know and love.
We also talk about what you're playing when you join our community.
Subscribe to Colette and Matt Have Entered the Chat wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
A feature I really love on the collection, Chris, is the fact that you basically can watch a long play of each game, but it's an interactive one in which you can skip through it, but you can just jump into the game wherever you want to jump into in that entire long play. I want to know how those came together and who is actually playing those portions.
Yes.
And
okay.
They seem to always be playing as Leonardo. I think I noticed that when I was watching them.
So how did this come together? This was something that I think Frank Cifaldi spearheaded this for SNK 40th, because his thing was, look, you know, these games, especially when you're talking about like obscure old SNK games, right? You know, for some of these games, like we need to present this in such a way that we're doing this historical presentation and to actually ask people to kind of wrap their heads around playing night arcade games from the 1980s. It's really kind of almost doing a disservice, because we should show people what it's like to play these games rather than force them to do it themselves. You know, it's all part of the historical presentation, you know, so it's almost like, you know, the idea of like, if this game was on display in a museum, you know, you could potentially like watch this playthrough. And so the way that this was, but then the exciting part is, as you say, you can just jump in whenever you want. So this was something that, you know, we loved, and we want to feature this in our collections whenever possible. The watch and play mode, you know, we had it in Blizzard Arcade collection as well. The designer's name, the guy who did the playthroughs, his name is Ted Church. He's awesome. We worked very closely together, on that and on, the tips and things like that that appear in the interactive strategy guide portion of Cowabunga collection, because he really made it his business to be like the in-house expert on the playthroughs of all these games. And then, yeah, we made the decision that, you know, for consistency's sake, let's have it always be Leonardo, just have it consistent across the board, so you know where you're jumping into. And then he made absolutely sure that each of these playthroughs, he never took any damage, which again, it got hairy, you know, with the arcade games, because if you go too long without taking damage, it makes you take damage. So we kind of had to like figure out ways around that. through judicious use here of saving and loading, because, you know, essentially when recording these watch mode playthroughs, you know, we can use save and load, and then we can also use rewind. So it's sort of like a tool assisted speed run, essentially, except it's not a speed run. Like, it's not supposed to be a superhuman, you know, race through doing things that a human couldn't, which is what a lot of TAS's tool assisted speed runs are. It is supposed to look like just a normal person playing through the game, but who just miraculously somehow never takes any damage whatsoever. And so that's kind of what it's supposed to be. And really, you can use this to just sit and watch the game being played through if you want, and that could be fun. Or, you know, you can use this as essentially fast forward. You know, because some of the games have level selects, and whether or not the game initially had that as a secret code, you know, for a lot of the games, we've included that as an enhancement. You can just pick your starting level. But this watch and play mode essentially allows you to start playing at any random sort of point in the game or any arbitrary point in the game. So if you want to practice one boss fight, just literally use this to fast forward to that boss fight. And then just start playing right there. Fast forward to it, start playing, save the game right there. So now I have a save right at the bottom. You know, you can essentially use this in whatever way you want to, either to watch a playthrough without having to play it or to really perfect your gameplay by being able to just pick any arbitrary point in time and just start there.
Yeah, I think the functionality is great, but also the context it provides is really great, because if you're a kid who didn't grow up with these games, or if you're maybe even 30 and didn't grow up with these games,
yeah.
You could play Ninja Turtles, the 8-bit version, and you can get to the underwater level and say, well, this is impossible. But then you mm-hmm. can watch a playthrough and say, okay, well, here's the route I can take. It's like how right. when I play a game now, instead of going to GameFAQs, I will look up a YouTube video of the part I'm stuck on and then watch someone else do it. And it feels like that's kind of the same thing at work here.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it just... We really love it. It adds it's just in this one feature, essentially, it adds so much richness and depth from so many different angles, as you say.
Yeah, I'm so used to the rewind button. You know, I've played a lot of games like this that have collections like this that have a rewind button, but to have a fast forward button that does, it's very novel. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, the rewind button, I think, is really clutch because, I mean, especially with something like Turtles 1, right? I mean, let's, you know, Cards on the Table, right? You know, Ninja Turtles 1 for NES is considered to be this sort of like legendarily difficult, maybe even unfairly so game, right? Well, you know, a lot of typically what happens with that game is you start playing it and you're doing okay, you're doing fine, doing okay. And then like in 2 seconds, you're dead because like you just sort of get nailed by enemies coming at you from all sides, or something hits you that you weren't anticipating, or you hit the seaweed 5 times and you shrivel up and die in the water, you know. And it's just sort of like with rewind, just the ability to just go back a few seconds and try it again, just that feature makes that game in particular so much more playable and more forgiving. And I think that people will start, it's like there's so much that's good about that game. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know what I mean? Because especially it's like, now we've all looked at these design documents. We understand how much went into it, you know, how well kind of crafted it was. The ability to just sort of rewind and try again, I just think it makes it so much more smooth to kind of go through and play it. And maybe for the first time for a lot, even for people who had this game growing up, this might be the first time you ever finish it, you know, and really appreciate everything about it because we've given you the tools and the enhancements and the rewind and save and load and the strategy guide and stuff like that to actually sort of tackle it on your own terms.
And Donatello never has to die.
Yeah.
Because once he's out of the picture, you can just reset your Nintendo. It's over.
Yeah, right.
Now, Chris, you mentioned the strategy guide. These are very cool additions to the Cowabunga collection because these are accessible through the Turtles Lair section, but you can actually access these through like the pause screen on any game, where you folks have basically put together a magazine-style spread of hints and tips and maps and stuff for each of these games. And jokes too, and
like, yeah, there's some great jokes in there,
and amazing, yeah. amazing original art that looks like it could belong in Nintendo Power or any magazine of that era.
So yeah, huge shout out shouting out people on the team, Nathan Lombardi, an amazing artist who is a Digital Eclipse, works out in Washington, and he was just like he understood the assignment. I'm like, Nintendo Power aesthetic. He's like, yep, I get it. I got it. And he cranks out these incredible pieces of art that, yes, look like they were just ripped right out of that perfect, like, it has that perfect, like, it's an English language magazine that was laid out in Japan kind of vibe to it. Nailed it in one. Also, Norm Badillo, another one of our artists, did a lot of the magazine, the page layouts and stuff like that. Charles, actually, at Konami, Charles Murakami, was like, oh, like, I used to write, you know, strategy guides and make maps out of screenshots, so I know how to do it. So I'll make the maps. We're like,
wow.
Okay, thanks. You know, so Charles made the maps, and then Norm took the maps and laid them out and drew the arrows and stuff like that. And just like the go get 'em attitude that everybody had to making this great was just fantastic. And so, yeah, we really, the strategy guide was like, it was born out of this idea of like, okay, this is a this is not simply a nostalgia play, but what do we do to kind of like contextualize this and talk about the era, you know, and what was it about playing these games? Like, they all had, you know, some of them straight up just had the Konami code in them, right? Whereas some of them had variations on that, but it was all about getting issues of video game magazines, going to the tips and tricks area to find to see if there were any codes or tricks or anything for these games, which they all had. And then also just, you know, the maps and the strategies and things like that. And sort of like having that external companion along with you while you were playing the game. Maybe one of the siblings is playing while the other one has the strategy guide or the magazine open. And so I'm just like, okay. And then additionally, we had the watch video technology, which was already part of the game. And so it was like, okay, great. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. We'll all. And then, of course, you know, me joining as a journalist, you know, when all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And I'm like, I'm going to write my way out of this, you know? And so it was, I'll just write a magazine. That's what I know how to do. And so it all kind of came together as, yes, the interactive strategy guide of, it looks like the pages have screenshots on them, but then many of those screenshots are actually videos. And the watch videos, the thing is, here's the thing, like, the watch videos, because you're playing as Leonardo and you're not doing, the watch videos are not about doing sneaky things. So like in Turtles 1, you know, the whole thing where you can beat Rocksteady just by hiding up on the crates and like stabbing downwards with Donatello's bow, that's not in the standard watch video. So we can do a watch video that just shows that, you know, in the strategy guide. If you just watch the watch mode, for Turtles 2 on the Game Boy, the turtle never gets captured, so you never have to play or you never see the bonus, the rescue game, where if a turtle gets captured, you can fight the Rex 1 robot to try to get them back, to try to get them out of jail. So then we can show that in the strategy guide, and you can look at that to see a perfect strategy for that, so that when you go in and when you inevitably get caught, because the game's really hard, you know, you understand a little bit more about what the strategy is. So it's just, it... Because, I mean, there's 13 games. They're all very different. We have straightforward action adventure. We have Brawler. We have Metroidvania with Radical Rescue. We've got one-on-one fighting games. So every section of the strategy guide is going to be different and tailored to what the needs of that game specifically are. And so it was a really fun challenge. It was super fun to do. And like, I'm glad that, again, then also, you know, fill it up with ridiculous jokes as well, because obviously, you know, just again, sort of trying to capture the ridiculous spirit of those 1990s publications. Right. And so, yeah. You know, it just trying for like, it's authenticity, but like authentic, but better, I think is the idea.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, really the grammar is all correct.
Yes. Yeah. You really nailed the aesthetic and the time period. One thing that touched my old man heart is that when you go to the Turtles lair, and you go to the section where all the strategy guide pages are, the thing that represents it is basically a parody version of those red border Nintendo Power strategy guides from 1990. Like, that was the perfect item to parody to represent all the work you did.
Thank you. Everybody top to bottom understood the assignment. It was great. I didn't have to explain this to anybody.
I also do love in the Turtles Lair going through the ads, because too, you can see in time how they start as these, you know, innocent late 80s ads that I knew them all because I was reading comic books at the same time, and they were usually advertising the back of comic books, and you can see it transition into the Play It Loud era of ads, and they get a little more sharpness to them, and that's just so cool to see all in one place.
The ad I don't like is seeing the arcade game get slimed and turn into the NES game. I'm like, did they slime a real arcade game?
It's amazing.
I hope not.
They may have. That might not have been. I mean, what's the cheapest way to do it? They've got an arcade game sitting around. You can buy a bunch of slime because it's the 80s and they just sell that.
That's true.
You know, yeah. I also love the Japanese ads, which I was sort of discovering as I was doing this. And we didn't, I know we didn't get them all, and it would have been very difficult to track down all of them because, I mean, first of all, a lot of issues of these Japanese magazines are not scanned, and some of these magazines were weekly, and so it's like there's just a ton of magazines that we'd have to go through even just to locate where they would even be. But we got a lot of them. I dare say we got the majority, a solid majority of the ads. And some of them, God, there's an ad for, I believe it was Hyperstone Heist, where, oh yeah, because it was Hyperstone Heist, the Japanese version of it, Return of the Shredder. And it's a combo ad for that and Castlevania Bloodlines, Vampire Killer, because they both came out. They were both at the same time. So we have the full combo ad for both of those in there, meaning there's like a Castlevania reference buried in here. It's a pun on Kame, which means turtle, and Kamu, which means to bite, as in a vampire biting you. And like, that's the pun. That's the strap line. Brilliant, brilliant ad. And then the Tournament Fighters ads get like super dark in Japan. Like the ad is like, there's like, it's like four kanji characters like above the ad, and it basically translates to like, the blood boils while the flesh dances. And it's just like this, wow, that is intense. It's great. I love them. I every time I discovered a new Japanese ad, I got very excited that we got to, again, you know, put it in there. And yeah,
I think the only thing missing, maybe you could patch it in later, Chris, I want an interview with the woman who played April O'Neil on the arcade cabinet, because a little bit of a crush on her when I was seven. Right. Let's track her down.
Yep.
But we're going to talk about the games very shortly. We've got about half an hour left. Before we leave this like interview portion, Chris, was there any particular game you gained a greater appreciation for having done this collection? Something you might not have missed in the past? Something you might have shrugged off in the past? Any one of these particular games?
Yes, I'll take this opportunity to apologize. I reviewed TMNT3, The Manhattan Project, when it originally came out. Now, of course, I was in sixth grade, so I reviewed it for my sixth grade class newspaper. But, you know, it was published. It was run off on a Xerox machine. So I will take when I reviewed it, the Super Nintendo was already out, and I was 12. And that meant that anything that was less quality graphics than the Super Nintendo was automatically bad, because like, no, see, this is the new machine, this is good, and everything that's less quality graphics than this is bad. So I gave it a very bad review, saying it looked ugly and, you know, whatever, and why wouldn't you play the Super Nintendo instead, sort of a thing. I recant. I take it back. I don't know if I can recall all of those issues that may be out there or not. I'm not really sure, but you know, the Manhattan Project is an 8-bit masterpiece. It is absolutely, they took the engine of Turtles 2 and they're like, okay, let's make a completely original game just for the 8-bit. And there's stuff in Manhattan Project, like with the character, I think it's Dirtbag, like you're fighting Dirtbag, and he, halfway through the fight, he walks into the background and there's a pipe on the wall, you know, like a drain pipe, and he walks back there and he rips off a section of the drain pipe. And he comes at you with it. And so for the second half of the boss battle, he's got the drain pipe in his hand. Now, as a kid, it's like, oh, that's cool. As an adult, it's like, oh my God, that's a completely separate set of sprites. That's like a completely separate character that they put in this. And this game has tons of levels and tons of animation. It's like absolutely maxing out what the NES can do and doing these things that are very resource intensive to just pull off a cool moment, like the boss goes into the background and just tears off a section of pipe and just starts beating you with it. It's like, that's not, anybody would have been called crazy for saying that they wanted to do that in an NES game. And there's just so many moments like that in Manhattan Project that just make it killer. All the turtles have unique moves. There's a much larger set of moves that you can do. You know, it's closer to a modern day, you know, brawler than the arcade game was, but because it kind of came out so late, not as many people got it. And then, you know, it's sort of a rare collective. I mean, it's not that rare, but it's not like Tournament Fighters NES rare, which is very rare. But, like, it's still kind of pricey now, so not a lot of people have it, not a lot of people played it. So the answer, the short answer, you know, is yes, Manhattan Project.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to be playing a lot of these games for the first time. I think that's one of them, and that's one I can say I didn't overlook it, and that's because I did not get a Super Nintendo until that Christmas, so I was still playing NES games for an entire year. But yeah, when you go back to it, you can see it as like, oh yeah, this is Konami in like basically one of the last viable years of the NES, like using all of their tricks. The soundtrack is great, the graphics are great, there are all these effects you've never seen before, and I imagine a lot of people were like, oh, Turtles in Time is better, or I'm playing my Super Nintendo, this looks like garbage. But now you can just see it as like one of the most finely crafted 8-bit games Konami ever made.
Yeah, no, the Manhattan Project is the one that filled me with the most regret too, because my little brother and I, some of my favorite moments in gaming we ever had was playing the arcade too on there on NES. But when Manhattan Project came out, and I remember seeing those ads that you have in the Turtles Lair. And when I saw those ads, I could tell from the pictures, like, oh, it's an NES game. We're playing Genesis now, and I'd rather just play Streets of Rage 2 or whatever. Like, I completely overlooked it. I wish I could go back and give myself the memories of going back to playing two-player with my brother with that game, with me as Leo and him as Mike, and just having an awesome time. And I'm so sad I overlooked it as a graphical snob of skipping that game.
Okay, so we're all on the same page here. Yeah, okay.
this collection will allow you to play Turtles games and get over longstanding regrets.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes.
Two promises.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, look, nobody had, you know, if you come to me and you tell me that you were a kid and you had all 13 of these games, I will be very impressed. I will be very impressed with how much money your parents had, because that's a lot of Turtles games to own. So for everybody, I'm hoping that there are going to be some games here that you've never played that you're going to get to experience for the first time.
Only Macaulay Culkin.
And there's some that are very worth it. only Macaulay Culkin.
Yeah, he's the only one that had all 13. So this is a good transition to talk about these individual games. We're going to try to get through all 13 quickly.
Let's go.
A few things about all of them, and maybe, Chris, you can talk about like enhancements. I did like play a little bit of all of these. So, of course, starting with the original Ninja Turtles for the NES. Again, yes, it's a difficult game. The rewind feature helps a lot. But what also helps is that you have options to turn off both flicker and slowdown, which makes these games a lot more playable.
Yeah.
Because when you play the originals, you realize, like, oh, the NES was kind of benching above its weight class in this, or fighting above its weight class in this, because it can only handle so many sprites, but you guys are able to give it a little bit of a boost and make this run much smoother than it ever did.
Yeah, and and this is something that, again, we would absolutely want to do, you know, in collections like this, because it is something, it's possible in our engine, it really improves the game for people. But then I'm also the guy telling everybody, okay, but default has to be with the slowdown on. Like, you know, the default experience, you press the button to play it, it should be as close to the original as absolutely possible. And then making sure that everything is called an enhancement. And then also it's like, you know, because it's the difference between, we call it the enhancements menu, it's not called like the options menu, and these things don't default to on. It defaults to the original historical item, and then you can then optionally, you know, change it if you want to. And there's always that restore to default button at the bottom that lets you take it back to where it was originally. Because for a lot of people, there's some people who are really good at this game, you know, and all of their muscle memory is based around the slowdown. You know, like everything they do is based around it feeling exactly like that. But yeah, Turtles 1, I think there's a lot of things, there's a lot of really interesting things about it that, you know, deserve to be appreciated.
In controversial opinion, possibly, I don't think the underwater level is that difficult. I think it's all psychological. Well, I looked at a video that when I was at 1UP, we did a live stream back in like the Justin.tv days, and I was able to beat the underwater level live, having not played the game in like a decade, under the pressure of a live audience.
Wow.
So level 3 is very hard. I think the dam level is achievable.
Once you actually do get through the underwater level, then you find out that like the game is like just starting to get hard.
Yes,
and
yes.
Things are about to get a lot more difficult. Yeah.
I had childhood anxiety dreams about that underwater level. I don't think I ever got past it. It was, it also wasn't as popular in our household. We owned the second NES game. We rented the first one because it wasn't one we could cycle through over and over again as a two-player thing for me and my brother. It was more of a, okay, you died as Leonardo, trade to me, and I'm going to play as Donatello, or vice versa. Like, it was really just, we played it as, until your turtle died, then it's, you, that was the turn system between me and my brother.
And, of course, up next is the original arcade game. This, I think, we can skip over because we've talked about it already. A lot of people have talked about it. It's legendary. And this will likely be the first game a lot of people play when they start the collection. But the good news is, you can skip to levels you might not have seen in the past without having to fight through the earlier ones because of the level select. So that's a nice additional feature there.
And also, you don't have to, like, return cans to the supermarket all summer to collect enough quarters to be able to power your way through and beat the entire game on a vacation, which I may have done.
God, the colors, just every time I play the first game, it's just the colors overwhelm me all over again. And I just remember feeling like, seeing that opening, I was like, oh, it's the cartoon opening right here, even though as an adult you can see where they made changes to it to fit stuff in. Or same with just hearing a turtle say words. Like, I was like, wait, this is the game? It can talk? Games can talk now?
Yeah. We do sound like people describing the first talkies,
yes,
though.
Yeah, I know.
We went through that era ourselves. I do want to highlight the NES adaptation of the arcade game, because I think people consider it irrelevant now that the arcade game is so playable. I think it's a very good NES game that I don't really consider a port. It's them basically taking the idea of the arcade game and then building it from the ground up for the NES. And I remember playing this with friends at the time. Nobody was disappointed in this game. No one thought, well, the arcade game looks better, or they talk in the arcade game, etc. Like, we realized, like, this was a very good game that could stand on its own, and there's even more content in this one.
In today's jaded times, it's fun to look back because, yes, when we got, it's like, yeah, we obviously knew that it did not look exactly like the arcade game, and that, in fact, it didn't look anything really truly like the arcade game, but when we got it, it was like, it's the arcade game in our house, finally! And it was just this absolute, just like, losing our minds with how cool it was to have this in the house. It was so, and you're right, it's like, it was not a port of anything but the feel. It was just the feel and the experience of what that game felt like. It was almost just like a brilliant original interpretation of that, to make it work on the console. And it was super good.
Yeah, it was all vibes, but it felt that way. Like, it just felt like I'm playing the arcade game now. And you know, you don't have the arcade game in your home to be on a screen right next to you to compare it to. So when it's just on your home TV, you're like, no, this is the same. Like, this is close enough. And it says arcade on the cover. And obviously it's not four player, but who could play four players at once on an NES? That wouldn't happen.
There's an adapter, but nobody has that.
No, we didn't. Yeah. My brother and I played it so much. That was the one we played endlessly, of like, okay, it's the snow level. Remember that guy's popping out there, that, or we'd also, like, such a great gift to the developers of this game was that the foot soldiers are easily interchangeable with colors. So you make the foot soldier sprite and then you can just adjust it for different abilities. Like, we would call the boomerang guys the banana guys. Like, a banana guy showed up, fight, get him. He's gonna hit you now. Yeah.
And were you fighting over the pizzas in the game?
Yes. No, my brother and I were not good at sharing. Both of us would eat. If we got to the pizza first, you're SOL. Like, sorry, that's mine. That's my pizza. I'm at full health. It's mine now.
There should have been a pizza sharing mechanic.
Well,
go ahead, Chris.
Well, as you know now, in the strategy guide, canonically now, there is the official who gets the pizza. Leonardo's pizza commandments are in there.
That's great. Yes, I love that. And as well, I think I tried to sell it to my mom as well. You know, it does cost this because we own this one. This was the one of the turtle, one of two that we owned. And I think I did sell it to her of like, it does come with a coupon, mom. So really, you're saving money. Like, this is less than it seems.
You can feed a child.
Yeah, me or Sam.
It's like we can go get a free personal pan pizza. It's like, no, the reason I don't want to go to Pizza Hut with you kids is not because of the cost of the pizza. You get your parents to take you to Pizza Hut, it's always sort of begrudging, like, all right.
So moving on here quickly through some other games. Fall of the Foot Clan, the first Game Boy game. This is just so evocative of what like the first 18 months of the Game Boy were like and the kind of experiences you could have. In that it is very built around the limitations of the Game Boy and its screen. Characters are very big. They don't animate very much because of blurriness on the screen. It's short, it's slow, it's easy, but it's all pretty solid. And I love how adorable all of the turtles look in this game. They are just so cute. They're always smiling. And that's what
they
I like
really
about
did
them.
A great job. And yes, for an early Game Boy game, they did a wonderful job drawing like big expressive sprites. You know, they definitely, yeah, it was absolutely designed in the sense of, well, people are going to play this on the go, right? Like they're going to like take it on an airplane and play it for a few minutes or something like that. And so like, let's put in a level select that's already sort of unlocked. So you can just pick what level you want to start in. Really, it's designed, you know, having thought about this and I've been like talking about it with people, like it, Fall of the Foot Clan feels to me like it's designed like a shooter. Like it feels like a Konami shooter. It's like, you can select what level you're going to start on. You can use the Konami code by pausing the game, put in the Konami code to refill your energy. And just the way that it's just about like advancing, letting the enemies come out, taking care of them, and then kind of advancing again. Just the pacing and the design of it, the way that the enemies sort of like appear on the sides of the screen, everything about it, like it almost feels like almost like a shooter type design to me. I think that's why I find it so appealing, because nothing really feels like Fall of the Foot Clan. It's this very, very interestingly designed game.
Yeah, I can see that, the way the enemies kind of come at you in waves, especially from above, those little kind of fly robots. Mm-hmm.
The
fly robots, they come on and they hover there, and then they attack you, like give you like time to get ready for it. It's very interesting. Hmm.
Yeah, and it works so well with the size of the sprites, because you know the Game Boy screen can only show so much, and if you're gonna make a sprite so cute and big, then you really only have the space of like, okay, there's space for the turtle, Foot Clan guy on your left, a Foot Clan guy on your right, and maybe some guys above you, like little things flying around. And so it's just about take two steps, clear screen, take two steps, clear the screen. Or like there is platforming, but not that much comparatively. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
No, I played this one second most. This was the only other one I owned, and it was like my prized Game Boy game. It was like I owned Land, Super Mario Land, Tetris, and this game. This was the three I owned for the start of the Game Boy, my early years of Game Boy, and I play this all the time. I think the cuteness did really pull me in, and just they're also like how cool they look, even just throwing stars. Mm-hmm. Like they just look so cute, and the sound effects too. Yep. Yeah. Oh, and the opening animation of just the sprites flying by, again, to my child brain, I was like, this, I'm watching the cartoon right here. This is the opening of the cartoon I'm looking at.
Yeah, very good cinema scene art. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, yep. I played this one a bunch. A friend had it on Game Boy, but I missed the other two Game Boy ones just because these were not the kind of games I was playing on my Game Boy. There's TMNT2, Back from the Sewers. I played a bit of this. To me, it feels like just they're kind of working on ideas for a Fall of the Foot Clan sequel, because it has a lot of the same like side-scrollery stuff, but then elements of the game are also a little more like the arcade game, in that you can move like up and down instead of just side to side, especially during boss fights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mean, if Turtles Fall of the Foot Clan was sort of like based around like what the perceived limitations of the Game Boy platform were, you know, then you see this evolution where they start transcending those limitations and finding out ways around them and building out. Yeah. So for Turtles 2, you can go vertical in these levels as well. And it almost, It just sort of like adding layers of complexity. And then, of course, with Radical Rescue, as I mentioned, it becomes a full-on Metroidvania with one very big interconnected platforming world that you have to explore and unlock new powers in the form of rescuing more turtles, which will then let you traverse more areas as well. So that one, I think, is going to be a big surprise to people who haven't played that. And that's actually very... Turtles Fall of the Foot Clan, I say as a video game collector, like Foot Clan is very easy to find. I think they sold a ton of them. Back from the Sewers, it's like significantly harder to find. Like they didn't sell as many copies. And then Radical Rescue is like very, very expensive if you find a copy of that.
Yeah, I think I never saw it in the wild. I might have not even known it existed until I did like a Retronauts about the Turtles series, I think 11, 12 years ago or something like that, where I just didn't know about this game. I didn't know how it played. And I think the optional improvements you folks made to this make it very playable. And I'm surprised you're able to rework the games in this way, and that you are given like a Castlevania style map in this game of the maze, and little dots represent things you're supposed to find, but you don't know what those dots signify. Well, you guys have hacked the game optionally. You can turn that on and new icons will appear to let you know what those dots represent. I don't know how you did that, but that is like, that gives the player so much more information that could help you play it in a more modern context.
You don't know how we did it, and quite frankly, buddy, neither do I. I know that Rich Whitehouse, who is our ROM engineer, essentially, is the one who goes into all of the original ROMs to essentially make the tweaks for these enhancements. And it's just funny, like, we just came up with all of this stuff that we could do by researching the games, and just everybody sort of joined together to sort of write out a whole list of, like, here's all the enhancements that would be really cool. And I don't even know if there were any that were on there where Rich was like, oh, that's not really possible. Like, most of it was just like, oh, yeah, yeah, I can do that. And he's like, all right, here you go. It's like, oh, okay, thank you. It's just great to work with geniuses. I don't know how they do it, but they do it.
Yeah, like a fantastic idea to help improve that game. And I think a lot of people will be playing that for the first time.
Yeah.
Want to move on though to Turtles in Time. So to me, this is a Super Nintendo game. I played the Ninja Turtles arcade game, the original one, at a lot of locations growing up. This arcade game was nowhere for me, so to me this is always a Super Nintendo game. But you were on our Simpsons arcade game podcast, Chris, like we mentioned. It feels like this and the Simpsons are both Konami's definitive statement on the brawler. Like, this is the most we can do. This is this genre perfected. And I love this game so much. There's so many ideas because of how often they can just jump to new different types of levels. There's a lot more humor in the sprites. Oh, they're being so a little funny. Looser with what they can do with the character designs. And it's just a very, very pretty, pretty game.
Yeah, and then you can read, one of the design documents is the original sort of concept document for the Super Nintendo version of Turtles in Time, in which they talk about, like, what is the concept for this game? It's like, oh, we're going to take the arcade game and we're going to bring it home, and, you know, we are going to add all of these features to essentially make it sort of like this sort of ultimate version of Turtles in Time. Clearly, I mean, both versions are excellent, and so many great ideas packed into them. But you're right. I mean, even in this case, these are probably the two. This is the situation where, like, these are the two games that are closest to each other as far as looks, right? As far as gameplay in this collection. But even so, they're quite different experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I had to read an article to teach myself how are they different. They're maybe like 20% different from each other, but they're still pretty important differences. But I can't say if one is better than the other. But the Super Nintendo one is the one that, like, I played the most with friends. So that's the one I have an affinity for.
Right. I mean, you probably could say that it was definitively better had it been four players. But
yeah,
that would have been a little bit too much to ask of the Super Nintendo at that time, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, the collection, especially with the multiple versions of Turtles in Time, which I actually think I played the most in arcade, and then for Genesis and Super NES, we just rented it, more Genesis. But it's given me a chance to really appreciate, like, the humor, like the comedic style of, like, just seeing, like, a foot soldier will walk out of somewhere you don't expect them to be. Like, I'm just getting, I mean, just the comedic sense of walking into a new screen and looking around of, like, where's the enemy popping out of in here? Is that car going to back out of me? Oh no, it was from the window or whatever. Like, it just, that was part of the fun every time.
Yeah. There's a certain friend I have, maybe a few friends, where I can just say the name of a level in the same way they say it in the game and get a laugh. Like,
yeah.
Big Apple, yeah, yeah. 3 a.m. Prehistoric turtle sword. I can say them all.
Yes. Yeah.
That's why it's perfect for me. Turtles in Time, like we said, listen to our Talking Simpsons about the Simpsons Arcade. It's on that level. Like, Konami just, they perfected the brawler, and I'm glad this is now available legally and digitally as well. So we also have the Hyperstone Heist, because Sega Kids could not get Turtles in Time. I'm sure there were rights issues, or maybe they
so
could.
That's what I was thinking.
Oh, yeah.
When I said Genesis Turtles in Time, I'm thinking of Hyperstone.
Well, you know, they are very close to each other, because this feels like it's built off of that foundation. Of course, they can't make it the same game. There are fewer levels, but they're longer. And no mode 7 effects.
I think that was right around the time where, yes, like Nintendo still had like an exclusivity clause. And so you saw publishers essentially trying to get around that, basically by making something that was similar, but ultimately it couldn't be the same.
Yeah, I mean, people rightfully complain about how some Genesis games sound. Konami really knew how to make it work on the Genesis, because this game has some great remixes of Turtles in Time music. Like, you don't think it's coming from the same machine that could produce music that was, you know, ear singeing in some games. So they knew how to work it well. And yeah, this is really the first time I dug into it, because it's like, well, that's a substitute for Turtles in Time. I don't want to play it. But no, it's a good game that stands on its own. I think Turtles in Time is better, but they made the most of the situation they were given, in which you can't just put Turtles in Time on the Genesis.
Right now, it all works out for us because, you know, the Super NES Genesis console wars are over and we can simply enjoy both games in, you know, one convenient package.
Yeah.
Yes.
Also on that topic, I also just love, in general, going through the ancillary stuff and seeing the Ultra Games logo again. Just seeing that, like, it feels so cool just to see it again. Yeah.
I do love Ultra Games. Mm-hmm. And we'll wrap up with Tournament Fighters. And an interesting time for the Turtles, because Street Fighter 2 is out in arcades. The Brawler, functionally dead in arcades. Fighting games are a big deal. Mortal Kombat, Street Fighter, etc. So Konami does the logical thing and says, let's make a fighting game. And they make three different versions of it. And they're all distinct with, you know, different rosters. And there's also a Nintendo one for the NES. And that, I think it could be possibly the only non-pirates fighting game on the NES.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's some that had come out in other territories, but I mean, yeah, if you were an NES player in the United States, only buying official games for your NES, that was the one and only, you know, one-on-one fighting game kind of in the wake of, you know, Street Fighter, essentially, that came out on the 8-bit platform, because I think that Capcom had looked at maybe even doing back in the day, like Street Fighter 1 for the NES. They had announced it but never did it. And so really it was only Konami that decided to go ahead with that. And it was the final NES game that Konami released. And it was deep into the 16, it was 94. It was very deep into the 16-bit era. And it was really when the 8-bit market was almost wound down. 94 was the last year for official Famicom and NES releases. And so to have it, just the fact that it exists is fascinating. The other thing is that three games, they're all titled TMNT Tournament Fighters, and they are all completely different games. Mm-hmm. Not just like slightly different, but like completely different plots, totally different gameplay, totally different rosters of characters. And so it's that even is another, you know, reason why, like, you know, they're all there. I mean, it's just like a completely different experience depending on which one of those that you play.
It taught me about the entire roster of characters that I forgot, like Ray Fillet, the Stingray.
Yes.
I was like, who is this guy?
Yeah, they had some deep cuts to fill out those games with individualized character rosters, for sure. But they're all, yeah, you know, characters from the comics. Yeah,
that's, you know, it's funny. I have the toys of Ray Fillet, Mondo Gecko, and Wingnut, so I knew them. But also in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Adventure comics, they did a shocking thing where they actually, like, killed all of them. Like, they die in a comic and go to hell. They get freed, but
wow.
The comic ends with them dead.
It was, okay.
It's a crazy thing they did. Again, this was in the For Kids comic. Like, this wasn't in the Eastman and Laird one.
Right.
No,
I love how this whole episode has been like, Henry, like, well, I didn't really have that many Ninja Turtles toys. And then it kind of, like, as the episode goes on, it's like, well, I guess I had Mondo Gecko and Wingnut.
Who didn't have Wingnut?
Yeah. And I mean,
Wingnut's great. I love Wingnut. I love Wingnut, and I really love, you know, again, like back into the Turtles Lair section of this game, go to the Tournament Fighters section, start looking at all of the character animation frames, because the people that were drawing these characters, especially for SNES Tournament Fighters, they love drawing Wingnut. Like, there's so many like hilarious sketches of Wingnut that are buried in this thing. It's so great.
And also in the Tournament Fighter games, the 16-bit ones, I love stylistically how they are capturing how the live action turtles look. Yeah. Like, they bring, especially like just seeing the turtle sprites and the drawings for the animation of the fights. I was like, wow, they went from drawing, doing the pixel version of my favorite cartoony turtles to now these great looking pixel versions of the, you know, approximation of a big rubbery puppet, you know?
Yeah. These games are fun, if only to just look at all the sprite art and all the different animations, just how meticulously they're crafted.
Yeah.
But I mean, I like these games, but they also fill me with a slight melancholy because having lived through this entire period, this is like the sense of childhood ending is sinking in around this time where it's like, yes, Ninja Turtles, the final movie comes out in 93. The cartoon starts winding down in, I think, like 94, 95-ish. And it feels like, oh, the Turtles are gone now. And that was like only really 4 years of my childhood. I mean, technically they started in 87 for most kids, but 89 is when the daily shows started happening. And then these 13 games came out in 4 years, basically. 4 years and some change. Like, just a short period of time for all of us as adults, but as a kid, it felt like an eternity. It felt like a decade, practically. So
yeah.
When I reach these, I'm like, oh, the turtles are going away. But now, for kids, it's like they never left. Like, for new kids.
Yeah,
It's just that time dilation is pretty crazy because, I was looking at, you know, He-Man and Masters of the Universe and, looking at there's a book that came out last year with all the toys and everything like that. And it's just like, oh, my God, this incredibly short span of time just felt like, you know, 2 decades to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about it with kids today of like, say, I paid attention to Steven Universe, the series, because I really enjoyed it from beginning to end, which was, I believe, 2013 to 2020 was when the final season of the final episode of the final season aired. And that 7 years to me, you know, it felt like a chunk of time, but not that huge. But if you were 8 when it started and 15 when it ended, like, that's it's an impossible amount
of time.
You
went through a lot.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah.
I wish my brother and I, we play Tournament Fighters a little bit at friends' houses, but we didn't get it because, again, from the same ethos of looking over, unfortunately, Manhattan Project, the same deal of like, well, Mortal Kombat's out now, and if we're going to ask our mom to get one thing, we're going to get this. And it made us overlook all these other fighters just because we were on to the new hotness, you know?
Again, you can finally get over your regrets.
Yes, yeah.
Not a guarantee. Yeah,
not a guarantee.
No, I mean, I just remember around this time like being interested in these games, but also Turtles were going away, and I remember I saw all the original Turtle movies in the theaters. No autographs, please. But when I went to see 3, I thought, it doesn't look good. I don't want to see it, but I feel like I owe it to the Turtles to see this one. So one of the very few people watching that third movie, which might be okay. I haven't seen it in a very long time.
Here's an admission about Turtles, the third Turtles movie that I did. We made, I don't know why, but for some reason my brother and I, or maybe it was just me, decided that we saw the first Turtles movies once in the theater. We saw Secret of the Ooze twice in the theater.
I can see where this
is
going.
So we said to my mom, well, we have to see it 3 times, and even by the second time for me, I was like, I don't think I even liked it all that much. And the third time I look it down, I was like, we got to do this third time. And I feel again, talk about regrets. I feel very bad. I made my mom sit through 3 times of watching that in a theater.
Oh gosh. Oh no.
You helped keep New Line Cinema in business, Henry.
Yes, yeah. It was a tough year for them. Yes.
But what a great collection of games, Chris. Very awesome work on this. I'm looking forward to everyone getting a chance to play this. This episode will be live by the time the collection is live, so let us know what you think in the comments. But Chris, anything else you want to plug? Do you want to talk about what you're doing online? Anything else that's going on in your life?
Oh gosh. Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, like, kind of, this is the big one. this game is finally getting out there, and everybody's gonna be playing it by the time this comes out. I'm just existing, having a good time.
That's fun.
Just excited for everybody to have this. Happy to have this conversation with you gentlemen, as
awesome.
Always.
Well, thank you for being on the show, Chris. And this has been an episode of Retronauts, by the way, in case you forgot. I've been your host, Bob Mackey. And of course, this is part of the HyperX Podcast Network. You can find us online at patreon.com/retronauts. If you sign up there for $3 a month, you can hear all these episodes 1 week at a time and ad free. For $5 a month, you can actually do the ahead of time and free thing. But also, you can get 2 full-length bonus episodes every month. We've been doing this for about, I think, 2.5 years now. So you've missed quite a few of our exclusive episodes if you're not on the $5 tier at patreon.com/retronauts. Check it out. That supports the show and it keeps us going and it gets you some cool stuff on top of that. Thank you for listening to this plug. Henry, what about you?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at HENEREYG. And of course, me and Bob do our own podcast together too on the Talking Simpsons Network. If you love all this nostalgia for cartoons, have we got a podcast for you, because we go through every episode of The Simpsons in chronological order. Right now, we are ping-ponging between season 3 and season 13 at the same time. And I guess it was 2 years ago now, or a year close to it, we did one about the Simpsons arcade game with Chris. It was so much fun to go level by level, screen by screen in some cases, through that game and the making of it. And we haven't actually done a Turtles episode yet. We've left that one untouched for a while, but we have so many great cartoons and animated movies we've talked about on the What a Cartoon sister podcast, and you can hear all of that a week at a time and ad free, as well as a ton of extras at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up there to get a monthly exclusive episode of us doing Talking Futurama and Talk King of the Hill, of us covering those two shows, as well as a huge back catalog of us covering Mission Hill, The Critic, our favorite episodes of Batman the Animated Series, and lots and lots more. And also, we do the What a Cartoon Movie, where we cover everything from Akira to a Goofy Movie, as I like to say. Check it all out at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
And thanks again for listening, folks. We'll see you again for another episode of Retronauts. Take care.